We are finishing up chapter 8 because somebody didn't quite get through it. So we're kind of on the end of chapter 8, which is not up on the screen because we're going to do this quickly. So we have Jeroboam, of course, 2 Kings chapter 8. We have Jeroboam, or Jehoram. There's lots of J kings. So Jeroboam is in the 15th year that he's the son of Ahab, king of Israel, in verse 16. And Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, became king. And verse 18, what does it tell us about how is his rule in God's eyes? Verse 18. Yeah, so it was not good. If your commentary on your kingship is you were just like Ahab, that's not a good thing. You're wanting some David commentary is what you're wanting on your kingship, not Ahab. The daughter of Ahab became his wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. So there's always this kind of influence on the house of Ahab. And it was under his rule that Edom revolted because of what God was kind of punishing him with that revolt. Also in verse 22, Libnah revolted. Remember we talked about when David finally had peace, or at least rest, or Solomon really was when we finally saw Israel in peace, was Solomon, and how that was a blessing. Well, God took that blessing away from them in this case. There's interesting commentary on the life of this king. In 2 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 20, there's a lot more in Chronicles about this guy. But it says that he departed with no one's regret. So this king pretty much kind of went, passed on into eternity to no one's regret. Nobody showed up. There were no mourners. So that's a sad, sad commentary on your kingship. And then Ahaziah succeeds him in Judah in 2 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 1 through 6. Also kind of have this in here. So Jehoram slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. And he was not buried with the kings. He was buried in that city, but not buried with the kings. In verse 25, in the 12th year, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, he reigned, giving us a time stamp on when he was reigning. Gives us 22 years old when he became king. He reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. Short. And his mother, Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri. Omri was a guy, if you back up a little bit, Omri was a guy that was like a really good commander that sort of brought some stability between the relationship between Israel and Judah. He brought some stability. They'd been fighting with each other. He brought stability. One of those ways was through marriage. And so here we have, we see that still here. So his mother was a granddaughter of this guy. And he walked in the way of the house of Ahab, and he did evil on the sight of the Lord, like the house of Ahab had done, because he was a son-in-law of the house of Ahab. So we see this continual influence. 2 Chronicles chapter 22, verse 3 says that his mother was the counsel to his wickedness. So it was his mom's fault. This continual counsel from the lineage of Ahab, or that influence is there. And we keep going on. At the end of this chapter, we see in verse 28, then he went from Joram, the son of Ahab, to war against Hazael, the king of Aram. Now, this Hazael is king in the northern part of, up from Israel, and they go out to battle with him. Now, what's interesting is, so Judah and Israel go up to battle. Judah was not supposed to do that. Jehoshaphat got in trouble for doing that, right? We know that God does not want Judah going making any kind of alliance with Israel and going out to war with him. Now, what's interesting is that the guy that's king right now is his uncle. It's Ahaziah, or Ahaziah is the nephew of Joram. So anyway, that's why, you know, you're going to go out to war with your uncle. And so it was his uncle that goes, that was made sick, or he was wounded, and he goes back to Jezreel to be patched up, and then Ahaziah goes back to be with his uncle. And that's where we finish up chapter 8. Chapter 9 is about to get crazy. Lots of people are going to die in chapter 9. So let's see how well we can get through this. So Jehu comes on the scene. We've seen Jehu before. Jehu's kind of been an in and out of things in the past. Now Elisha the prophet in verse 9, chapter 1, or chapter 9, verse 1, let's flip that. Now Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophets and said to him, "Gird up your loins," that means get ready, "and take this flask of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth-Gilead." We saw Ramoth-Gilead earlier. Why is Ramoth-Gilead, where did we just see that? In chapter 8, verse 28. Why is that city important? Because that's where they are in war. Yes, that's where they've all encamped there, and that's where they're fighting. And so he sends them there. And he says, "When you arrive there, go search out Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and bid him arise from among his brothers and bring him to the inner room and take the flask and say, 'Thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel.'" Now, where have we heard this before? Remember, way back in 1 Kings... Way back in 1 Kings, what was Elisha supposed to do? God says, "Why are you here, Elisha? Get up. I got some things for you to do." One of them was to anoint Jehu. And so it's Elijah who's fulfilling that. So now is the fullness of time where that needs to happen. Jehu needs to be anointed now. And so it's Elijah who's fulfilling that in this moment. And so they go. So this guy runs over to Ramoth-Gilead. He goes into a tent where the commanders are, and he says, "Oh, captain." And everybody's classic situation. Everybody says, "Yes." They turn around. It's like going into a room and saying, "Jose." And everybody turns around and says, "Yes." So in this situation, they say, "Which one?" So he finally finds Jehu. He goes and tells him the whole long story. This is what you're supposed to do. He's anointing him king. And what else is he supposed to do? If you look here, beginning of verse 6, 6 through 10, we have this whole list of things that he's supposed to do. What are some of the things he needs to do in this section? Yes, we're getting rid of Ahab. We're a whole regime change. It's control, delete again, and we're getting rid of all those guys. And Jehu's the guy that's going to do that. We're also getting rid of who? Ahab, and we're going to be getting rid of Jezebel. Finally, and so all these things are going to be taking place in this chapter. So he was commanded to do that, given that information, and then open the door and just run, get out of there. And so when he runs away, Jehu comes out of the tent, and his friends are like, "What did that madman want with you?" Maybe he was dressed like Elijah. Maybe he, they know that he was the son of the prophet, and they just think they're crazy. Anyway, so he's, "What is that madman want to do with you?" And he kind of gets around to tell him he kind of said that I'm anointed king. And how did his friends respond to that? Man, they were on it, right? They threw some clothing down at his feet and said, "Man, you're it." And they get up and they announce that he's king, and we start this process of a regime change. In verse 14, we kind of start get rid of Joram. And they say, "Well, if this is going to be the case, if this is in your mind, verse 15, then we need to make sure that nobody escapes and nobody goes and tells him what's about to happen." So they need to leave first and get over to Jezreel, where the king is. And so they go over there. And on their way there, you have the watchman. There's a city watchman. There's a city watchman up on the tower. And he says, "I see somebody coming. Hark, somebody cometh," right? The dust trail, you can see people coming, right? So here they come. He says, "I see a company," and they say, "Is it peace?" And so they send somebody out to ask him, "Hey, are you coming to peace?" And Jehoram says to the guy that was sent out, "What have you to do with peace? Turn in behind me," right? So he's the commander. He can say to this guy, "It's none of your business, fall in line," right? He can tell that to this guy. So another guy is sent out. And same thing, fall in. It doesn't matter, just fall in. So the guy falls in behind him. And the king's kind of annoyed that he's not getting a message back whether or not this guy's coming in peace or not. So, you know what the king does? Well, I'm just going to ride out there with him. I'm going to go out there. You know, it's so hard to find good help these days. So the king and his nephew, who's the king of Judah, go out to meet him. And when they go out to meet him, what do they ask him? He said, "Are you coming in peace?" Right? In verse 22. "Is it peace, Jehu?" And he answered, "What peace so long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many?" So, it's an opening line, right? What did he just call his mom? Anyway, so Jehoram reigned about. So he's in a chariot. He reigned about, and he said to Ahaziah, "There is treachery, O Ahaziah," and they try to get out of there. And Jehu shoots his bow, and it says that he drew the bow at full strength. So you can kill, like, any archers in here, anybody? So you can kill a guy. You don't have to draw at full strength, especially if you're in, like, close range. It's like giving them both barrels when they're 3 feet from you, okay? It's a little bit overkill. So he shoots him through the back, comes out his heart, and sticks in his chariot. Is the effect, and he falls down dead, and Ahaziah runs off, run away, and tries to get away, and he is eventually hunted down as well. Now, what's interesting is, where did they have this meeting? In verse 21, where does it say they are when they have this meeting, when the chariots finally come to stop, and they have this encounter? Naboth's vineyard. What happened with Ahab and Naboth's vineyard? Didn't he want that? And then he pouted because he couldn't get it. And so Jezebel just killed everybody and said, "Here you go. It's that easy. You just got to kill everybody." And so, and the Lord said, "It's going to happen to you and to your descendants." And so that's exactly what happened. Jehu was there when the message was given to Ahab. Jehu heard that. And so he lays the body of the king in that place. "Surely I've seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood." So he's recounting what he heard. And so Jehu makes that happen. And so that word of the Lord is fulfilled in this moment about Naboth's vineyard. And then Jehu assassinates Ahaziah and begins to just clean house. Ahaziah is a descendant of Ahab, so he's got to die. And so he's making sure that happens. 2 Chronicles chapter 22, verse 7 says this was from God. What he was about to do was from God. And so they go through, and he is eventually found and shot, wounded by an arrow, and then goes on to Megiddo, and that's where he eventually dies. And they come and find him and carry him away, and he's buried in the city of David as well. And it kind of gives us just a timestamp as far as like his rule there in verse 29. And then verse 30, when Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, and she painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out the window. Now, she knows there's this coup. She knows that. And she decides to do what? Put her face on. There's been a whole lot of debate about, well, why was she doing that? Was she trying to look nice for her death because she knew she was going to die? Was she trying to, you know, it's like bat her eyes at Jehu? Probably not. She's already kind of, you know, she's been around a while at this point. So there's no, it's a guess. But she decides to put her face on, which was something that they did back then. We know the Egyptians did that. So anyway, so she's doing it. And so it's interesting in verse 31, as Jehu entered the gate, she said, "Is it well, Zimri, your master's murderer?" Zimri had done the same kind of thing. Zimri was a guy that was a commander who had killed and done a military coup. And so she's kind of referencing that in this moment. That was in 1 Kings chapter 16. And so he lifted up his face to the window and basically calls out to whoever's in the room and says, "Who's on my side? Are you guys going to be on my team?" Some guys look out the window and kind of give him the wink and the thumbs up. And then they do what? They toss him out. They toss her out. What's the commentary about this, by the way? What does the Bible say about Jezebel? He said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down. And what does it say about her? She splattered. you know, I see in my mind, like a movie of somebody tumbling out of the castle, is hitting every little stone along the way and finally hitting on the ground. Yes. So it goes, what do they do? So she doesn't just get thrown out of the window. What else happens? They run over her with the chariots. They run over, put it in reverse, back it up, run over, and do it again. They run over her. Right? Yeah, so they're running over her. And then what do? Let's go eat. We're done. Let's take a break. It's killing me. So they go inside, and they eat. And then eventually they say, well, we got to go take care of that because she's a king's daughter, blah, blah, blah. And then what do they find when they go out to take care of? They don't find much of anything, right? I mean, there's a skull that's been all gnarled up. If you've seen dogs chew on dead things, and like palms of her hands and feet, that's it. The Bible said that this was going to happen, and that they would not have enough pieces to identify that it was anybody, right? So anyway, that's exactly what happened. And so there wasn't enough pieces of her to even identify her body. And 1 Kings chapter 21 to verse 23 is where that takes place. So another thing the Lord has said comes to pass. Chapter 10, we have further judgment on Ahab's house. Ahab had 70 sons, and they had to die. Let's see if I get this up here. We're continuing this kind of, things are kind of low politically during this time. Continue the judgment on Ahab's house, and hopefully we'll get through chapter 10. So he had 70 sons, and Jehu writes to the ones that are taking care of his sons, and basically says, you know, pick the best one, and if you want to put him on the throne, then we'll fight about it, and we'll see who wins, right? He's given him a chance. He's given him a chance. And what is their commentary over in verse 4? But they feared greatly, right? It's like, this dude's already killed two kings. What are we going to do? So they said, no, we're good. We're good. Whatever you want us to do, we'll do what you want us to do, is basically what they said. The household, the one who's over the household, those who are over the city, the elders, the guardians, all the leaders, everybody involved in that were like, no, we're cool. Just whatever you want us to do, we'll do that. And he basically says, we're your servants, we'll do those things. And he says, at this point, all right, if you're on my side, here's what you need to do. You need to cut them all their heads off and bring them to me by tomorrow. That's what you need to do. So what do? They cut all the heads off of them, put them in baskets, took them to where he was, about 20 miles away, and had them there on time, probably with a bow. They didn't go. The men who were, they sent people out there, right? If somebody is like doing a coup and he's killing people left and right, and you're a prominent person, you may not want to be involved in that, right? Let's send the pawns. And so they sent somebody out to do that. And they brought the heads out to Jezreel, and they put them on either side of the gates, the city gate, on two piles. So you have two piles of heads, 35 heads. I'm guessing that's maybe this tall. I didn't Google that, but, you know, anyway. Morbid, Josh. What are you talking about? So here they have those heads, and he's basically trying to make a saying. This is what's happened. He says, "I killed the some people." In verse 10, he says, "Know then that there shall fall to the earth nothing the word of the Lord, which the Lord spoke concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord has done what he spoke through his servant Elijah." So he's basically keeps bringing this up. This is what God wanted. God said it was going to happen, and we're doing this. This is what we're doing. Okay, and so he goes along, and he's going down to a certain area, and Jehu met some relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and he said, "Who are you?" And they answered, "Oh, we're relatives of Ahaziah, and we've come down to greet the sons of the king of the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother." Now, what's interesting is it's been a couple days since this coup has been going on. News probably travels fast. They should know better, right? They should know better. So maybe they were supporters that were trying to come up and trying to do like a counter thing. We don't know. But whatever they said, it was a wrong thing to say. Because what happens to these dudes? Dead. They get dead too. So, I mean, again, everybody's dropping. Which you see when they talk about the queen mother, who are they talking about? Jezebel. So you know they're team Jezebel. So, you know, we want. So those 42 men are dead. And then he goes up and he goes and finds this. I have a hard time. Jehonadab, thank you, the son of Rechab. This guy is mentioned in Jeremiah 35. Jeremiah 35, 6 through 10. Why is he mentioned there? He's mentioned because he's sort of this zealot, really pious guy. They live out, they're not supposed to, his clan and his people are not supposed to own any property, not supposed to have a vineyard, supposed to rely on God. And he's a very, very ascetic type of person. So he's a very, very conservative Jew. And he goes and finds this guy and says, hey, do you like what you see? Essentially is what he's saying to him. And the guy's like, yeah. And so he's like, he brings him up into his chariot and he says, come and see my zeal for the Lord. And that's what he says in verse 16. Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord. Which you can kind of see that happen in other times. Like Saul of Tarsus. Do you think he thought in the back of his mind he was a type of Jehu? Come and see my zeal for the Lord as I persecute Christians. So it's not, you know, when you see Saul of Tarsus in the New Testament doing these kind of things, you're thinking, who is this guy that he thinks he's going to kill everybody? That's what they did. And so he's kind of trying to do that same kind of thing. So in this situation, he go up to Samaria, we have the destruction of the Baal worshippers in verse 18. Jehu gathered all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal in verse 18. Ahab served Baal a little. Jehu will serve him much. And so he's making out to be this big Baal worshipper. And he calls them all together. And I says, "If I want all the Baal worshippers to come together. If you don't show up, then you forfeit your life," kind of thing. "We're going to make this big sacrifice." It's sort of something that's done whenever there's a new leader. They have this big kind of sacrifice to kind of inaugurate their leadership. And so he's saying, I'm going to do that. And so he calls them all in. He even has them put on special garments in verse 22. He also says, search and see that there are here with you none of the servants of the Lord, but only worshipers of Baal. This is just our thing. This is our gig. We're not having anybody that's not a Baal worshiper in here. We're going to dress in black and yellow. And we're going to make sure that all the Baal worshipers are in here together. And so once they get them all in there, and he stations 80 men on the outside around and kind of gives them the heads up about what's going to happen. So they finalize the ceremony, and then he brings in the commanders, these 80 men, and they start to just kill them all. They kill all the Baal worshipers. Sort of like a little trap, maybe. So he kills all of them, and they tear down the temple. And so they don't let anybody come out. And so then they eradicate Baal worship. Verse 27, what do they do to that temple? Once they tear the temple down, what do they do with that area? They made it into a latrine. That's where they put all the refuse from the city is there, so that it will no longer be used for anything like that. And so Jehu, verse 28, thus Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. Verse 29, what does it say? However, comma, as for the sins of Jeroboam, did he get rid of the golden calf and that system? No, he did not. There is no good king in Israel because he was so close. It was a half measure. If he had gone the next step and gotten rid of all the forms of false worship, he would have been like the only good king. But he didn't do it. He was just really close. He didn't do it. But the Lord did say to him that he will get to serve four generations, will sit. But he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he did to sin. Which there's going to be a lot of sins laid at the feet of Jeroboam on the day of judgment, the things that he did to lead Israel astray. Verse 32, what does it say about his reign, or about at least what happens during his reign? Does he get peace? Does Jehu get peace? No. Hazael continues to be a pestilence and begins to come in and take different parts of Israel away, or at least conquer different parts. Then verse 34, now the rest of the acts of Jehu are, and all that he did in his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles, the kings of Israel? So Jehu sleeps. He reigned over Israel, or Samaria, was 28 years. Okay. Now, chapter 11. Chapter 11, we have a queen of Judah for a while. A queen of Judah. All right, so we're going to back up. Chapter 11, verse 1, if you're doing this, remember we're doing this kind of timeline where it goes along for a while, we follow Israel, then we cut and go back to Judah. And so we're doing that same kind of cut where we're cutting and we're going back to Judah, back to chapter 10, verse 28, when Ahaziah was killed. Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Now, wait a second. Let's put this in perspective. She hears that her son dies. And she gets up and kills who? All her other sons, which are her grandchildren. She doesn't have pictures of them in her wallet, does she? She's not one of those kind of grandmothers, right? So she kills all the offspring, except one is left, right? One is saved. Jehosheba, the daughter of King of Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from another king's son. He's about a year old when she does this, and takes him and hides him in him and his nurse, hides him in the in an area where they keep mattresses or whatever. Chamber of mattresses is technically what this is called. Could be a bedroom, but they hide the child. No. Too short. Now, when he becomes 7 years old, there is another coup. And chapter 23 of 2 Chronicles highlights this coup and gives us some different details. But it is the high priest that kind of helps this, makes this possible. So during that time, during that six-year period, you have a female, this queen, ruling. This queen was the daughter of none other than Jezebel, right? So where'd she learn it from? She learned it from mom. This is how you do stuff, right? And so it's Jehoiada that brings, who is at that time the high priest. He kind of orchestrates, they kind of keep things chill until he's seven. And then he orchestrates this coup where he has everybody in place. And then they announced this king and put him in the, and do all the little things that you're supposed to do to announce a king. And she comes running out saying treason, right? Treason, which is ironic because what had she done? The very same thing, right? And so they basically begin to kill anybody. It's the order, they're given orders to kill anybody who approaches a king because this is the only one they have left. This is the last of the house of David, right? What's interesting is that when they have this coup, when they finally do this, they get weapons out of the temple. Whose weapons are those in verse 10? David's weapons from 135 years ago. We pulled David's weapons out of the temple and used those to defend the last remaining of David's line. So cool. That's really cool. That didn't have to be in the Bible. They just could have said, we're going to use some weapons in the temple. But they get to tell us that it's David's weapons that he had that are defending his last last heir. And so they do this. They kill her. They take her out to some gate, some random gate by the horses, and kill the queen or kill this Athaliah person. And he becomes king. And so Jehoiada made a covenant in verse 17 between the Lord and the king and the people that they would be the Lord's people and between the king and the people. In verse 18, all the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down, his altars, his images, and they killed the high priest of Baal and before the altars and all the officers. And then he put in place the people that needed to be as far as protecting, taking care of the temple. in the king's house. Chapter 23, verses 18 and 19 of 2 Chronicles talks about the things they put in order in that time. And so Jehoash was 7 years old in verse 21 when he becomes king at the end of chapter 11. And so chapter 2 Chronicles chapter 24 coincides with chapter 12 of 2 Kings, and we'll look at that next week. Any questions, comments, shout outs? Okay. Thank you very much for your time tonight. Thank you.